Let us, just for the moment, take a brief respite from the epic tales of gods, great men, and battles that dominate our narrative. Rest assured that we will return to these subjects soon enough because of how prominently they figure in the two centuries of Akkadian rule. So much so that normally sober-minded historians have referred to it as the heroic chapter of Bronze Age history. The barely concealed excitement of these historians comes from the fact that Mesopotamia now had larger-than-life, world-changing figures of flesh and blood, like Sargon the Great and his grandson Naram-Sin. Figures whose historicity is better accounted for than that of Gilgamesh, that other giant of the Mesopotamian canon. As such, it is all too easy to forget that there were ordinary people out there, the playthings of these heroes, who spent their days eking out what then constituted an ordinary existence. Surrounded by violence and preoccupied with basic subsistence, the sons and daughters of this earliest of empires leave behind evidence of a sophisticated civilization, with a dynamic, cultural, artistic, and intellectual scene that was both a continuation of the rich past, but also evolving towards something grander. It was an evolution, in both substance and style, in the direction of empire. We can characterize the Akkadian Empire as a decentralized and tributary one, affording a significant degree of autonomy to each city so long as it paid up with grain, silver, or other commodities. And because it came so early in the human story, it did not actually call itself an empire. Terms such as emperor or imperial did not yet exist, and so you'll hear me speak of kings and royals today, even if, for all intents and purposes, the Akkadian Empire was something very different from the Mesopotamian kings that had come in the past. Now, in describing the Akkadian Empire, I mentioned that it was decentralized. This would be a recurring pattern with pre-industrialized agrarian empires, in which the imperial apparatus is only so sophisticated, and the watchful eye of the ruling court extends only so far. Add to that the storied past of Sumerian civilization, with its wellsprings of political, cultural, and intellectual innovations, and the fundamentally decentralized nature of Akkadian rule becomes even more palpable. As such, the Akkadians permitted the cities of Sumer to speak Sumerian, worship the same patron deities, and celebrate feast days in accordance with their own calendars. Not only that, the Akkadians borrowed and built on these traditions, co-opting cuneiform writing and the idea of the divine right of kingship. Before Sargon's conquests, the Akkadians had mere hegemons whose legitimacy was derived solely from their ability to overpower or outmaneuver opponents. But once the Akkadians found themselves in control of Sumer, they quickly adapted the idea of universal, god-ordained kingship, which was by then enshrined in the Sumerian king list. This debt to Sumerian civilization did nothing to dampen the seemingly unquenchable Akkadian demand for tribute. In fact, the idea of universal kingship, brought into practical being for the first time, may have merely fueled it. The collection of tribute was indispensable to the management of the Akkadian Empire. First, for feeding the urban population of Akkad and other cities with insufficient grain reserves, and secondly, for the armies that were responsible for squashing resistance at home and securing plunder abroad. Although Sargon initially kept the Sumerian ensis, or lords, in charge of their respective cities, after a series of rebellions broke out against him and his successors, they gradually became replaced by Akkadian ensis. It fell on these ensis to collect tribute from their subject populations. Unlike the Mesopotamian nobility of later times, this new class of ensis did not find it necessary to make any claims about a long and illustrious lineage, most likely because they had no such noble pedigree to speak of. As we noted in the last episode, many of the new Akkadian elite did not even come from Akkad. Instead, this class was characterized primarily by loyalty to the royal family, which was proved through continual demonstrations of fealty in the form of gifts, feasts, military service, able administration, diplomatic entreaties and orations, and of course, tribute. In return, Akkadian elites were rewarded with bountiful tracts of Sumerian farmland. Some of this land was newly cultivated, but much of the best land was bought or outright confiscated from the original Sumerian landlords, an increasingly disaffected class that had good reason to be outraged by the ostentatious displays of wealth exhibited by this class of nouveau riche Acadians. One such display of wealth was the collection of slaves and servants that Acadian elites would keep sequestered in their household. Most of these slaves had Sumerian or Akkadian names. Some had families, but many were single women who had been taken captive. They were rarely freed, often attempted to escape, and could be branded or otherwise mutilated by their owners. In other words, this was a form of chattel slavery, whereby slaves were property to their owners. However, unlike the slavery practiced by the Romans and other civilizations, slaves were a small minority of the Akkadian population, and were not put to work on vast agricultural estates or grand building projects. Instead, slaves were used for household work, and interestingly, the words for servant and subject were the same as the word for slave. Indeed, in some cases, the lot of an everyday subject of the Akkadian Empire, engaged in backbreaking labor in the fields, may not have been much better. Let us now speak about what the life of this everyday subject was like. Among historians studying this period, there are two models of the Mesopotamian economy. The first model claims that Akkadian governance involved the redistribution of basic necessities from the landlords to the masses, who were compensated for civic or military service. As such, there was little need for an open market. The second model holds that most of the population tended to be self-reliant, and left to their own devices when it came to matters of subsistence and the accumulation of resources. Communities that preceded the Akkadian period stayed intact, and shared the risk of bad harvests, floods, and disease. The second model seems closer to the truth, and more in line with our understanding of the Akkadian Empire as a decentralized one. There is some evidence of the distribution of rations within the confines of the long-established temple system, army, and building projects. But on the whole, the Akkadians behaved like conquerors. They took more than they gave, exploiting populations, foreign and domestic alike, for grain and luxury goods, which could then be used to pay for the means of exploitation, that is, the armies. Herein was a self-reinforcing cycle, a genuine paradigm shift from the days of pre-Akkadian Sumer, when the average city worked to gain an agricultural surplus that it could then use to trade with other cities and afford a labor force for the completion of civic projects. Nonetheless, more recently, scholars have emphasized that there were moderating influences, like the temple system and local assemblies. It would fall on the kings of Ur who would succeed the Akkadian Empire to centralize things further, by maintaining a large, dependent pool of labor. But the common thread, before and after the Akkadian conquest, was that agriculture formed the backbone of the economy. Most people worked the land and ate what they grew, or at least what remained of it. These people either owned a farmstead or rented one from a landlord. Barley and wheat were the most common crops, although we know of quite a range of foods and spices that were grown or gathered, like onions, lentils, chickpeas, dates, figs, apples, grapes, pomegranates, coriander, cumin, cress, honey, syrup, and nuts. On average, the size of a privately owned farmstead was 6 hectares, while a tenant farm was double that, 12 hectares. In tenant farms, roughly one-half to two-thirds of the crop would go to the landlord, while the remaining crop would suffice to feed a family of about 6 people. After much of Sumer's most arable land was redistributed to royal favorites, such small farms were joined together to form sprawling Akkadian manorial estates. This constituted a fundamental difference between Sumerian and Akkadian agricultural techniques. While Sumerian agriculture was marked by intensive cultivation of small tracts of land, Akkadian agriculture was extensive. The Akkadians simply had a lot of land that they could till, and they entrusted vast tracts of this land to royal favorites. This allowed the Akkadians a measure of control over grain flows. We hear of 900,000 liters of barley being carefully accounted for in the city of Adab, with more than 100,000 liters being sent to Akkad, according to the cuneiform dictate of a scribe's clay tablet. In the northern parts of Sumer and in Akkad, a different form of subsistence dominated, animal husbandry. Sheep, cattle, goats, and donkeys were raised, producing wool, milk, leather, and meat, all of which were valuable commodities. Curiously, we also hear of a hybrid draft animal called the kunga, part domesticated donkey and part wild ass, its convoluted heritage was the butt of Sumerian jokes. There is not much record of poultry during this period, but we do hear of geese, ducks, and fowl being fattened in preparation for feasts. There is similarly no record of pig husbandry, but we find no evidence for the consumption of pork being considered a taboo. In fact, it may have been a delicacy. The third form of subsistence, alongside farming and animal husbandry, was fishing. As a former river valley civilization, one expects this of the region. And sure enough, there is an old Sumerian proverb that went as follows, quote, "Be there commerce in a city, a fisherman caught the food," end quote. We know of a delivery of 60,000 fish along with turtles and water birds that made their way from Lagash to Akkad. And we also know that the Euphrates great carp and Nagar catfish were great delicacies. Notwithstanding the importance of this economic activity, fishing was a menial, smelly, and low-status profession. Boat building, on the other hand, seems to have been a greatly respected profession, with chief boatman being an important title at court. Slaves that knew this craft also fetched a better price. And little wonder why. Boats sailing up and down the Tigris and Euphrates were indispensable for the transport of grain and other basic commodities powering the Akkadian economy. Because limiting factors existed in the form of a lack of wood, unstable currents, and the diversion of waterways for the purpose of irrigating crops, artificial waterways and canals were made in the pursuit of efficiency. The average Akkadian barge was roughly 5 to 7 meters wide and 12 to 15 meters long, capable of carrying a whopping 30 to 40 tons. The word for great boat was magula, or so we think, while the word for a plain old regular boat was asmagur. But no matter how one subsisted, grain was the most important commodity by far, serving as a sort of proto-currency used for the purchase or sale of goods, lending, leasing, and more. We know, for example, of a temple official in the city of Adab purchasing a journey for 300 gur, i.e. 900 hectoliters of grain. Silver functioned in much the same way, and merchants would source distant goods for people by accepting either silver or grain in exchange. That leads us to the other trades that were practiced in the Akkadian Empire, whose practitioners did not work the land and had to rely on selling their goods in order to provide for their families. Two such trades were woodworking and metallurgy. Although our knowledge of woodworking is obstructed by the fact that works made out of wood decompose all too quickly, we must imagine that there were some spectacular creations made of willow, tamarisk, pine, date palm, poplar, hackberry, juniper, fig, olive, cedar, Persian oak, and more types of trees. We know much more about metallurgy, which had a long pre-Akkadian tradition. In fact, by the time of the Akkadian Empire, there were already 128 words in the lexicon devoted to the description of copper instruments. But these craftsmen, whether they worked with wood or metal or other materials, did not figure highly in the social hierarchy of the empire, an all too unfortunate mistake of basically all agrarian civilizations right up to the 19th century. Nonetheless, we see the scope and scale of these crafts reach new heights, as for example with the experimentation with alloys. The most famous of these alloys, one of copper and tin, is bronze, which gave its name to this epoch in history. At this time, the bar for what constituted bronze among historians is quite low, at about 2 to 5% tin content. The rarity of tin is what made bronze uncommon. Copper, by comparison, could be sourced from nearby Kurdistan and Iran, and could be combined with silver, arsenic, and lead to form different alloys. In addition to its possible use in alloys and as a proto-currency, we see silver being incorporated into utensils, jewelry, and diadems, which must surely have impressed even as they further widened the gulf between rich and poor. We also observe the first large-scale copper works being made using a technique involving the creation of a wax figure covered in clay and melted so that a clay mold remains. This allowed the craftsmen to pour molten copper into it. We do not know if the Akkadians invented this technique, called the lost wax process, only that the scale of it surpassed what came before. In general, a hallmark of the Akkadian Empire, as with many other imperial civilizations, would be the profusion of raw materials that flooded into its borders as a result of conquest and trade, mainly metals, woods, and stones like lapis, carnelian, and serpentine, all admired for their exoticism. This, combined with the eagerness of a newly ascendant aristocratic class to display its wealth, created a flourishing market for luxury goods. As such, workshops expanded in size and sophistication, with tasks becoming specialized and mass production techniques being developed, especially with pottery. Now, let us talk about what we know of the people themselves. In inscriptions, we hear the Sumerians called the black-headed ones for their dark hair, though we must imagine that the Akkadians, the Semitic neighbors to the Sumerians, looked quite similar. Men and women alike wore their hair long, and as far as we can tell from the steles, the men seem to have sported mullets. Truthfully, the fact that we can say the mullet is one of the oldest hairstyles out there, and is well attested to by Bronze Age era steles, caught me utterly by surprise. Noble men and women, on the other hand, had more elaborate hairdos, sporting braided coiffures. A statue we once believed to depict Sargon of Akkad, which we now think represents Naram Sin, has an impressive man bun that holds up pretty well even in this day and age, unlike the mullet. To further set themselves apart from the masses, the elite would also wear silver and gold necklaces along with other jewelry, cosmetics, and lavish clothing. In the age of Naram Sin, something like a sartorial revolution took place. We see Akkadian elites wearing togas that were tucked into a corner over the right breast, secured with a garment pin. It was the beginning of a Mesopotamian fashion that would last centuries. In addition to sporting new hair and clothing styles, members of the Akkadian aristocracy would amuse themselves with lavish feasts with a stunningly wide array of foods available, especially when a royal delegation was in attendance. We hear of beef, mutton, goose, and venison, as well as other game being served, probably much to the pleasure of a ruler like Naram Sin, who was something of a prolific hunter. In addition to game, dishes with chickpeas, lentils, nuts, cheese, honey, juniper berries, apples, figs, and dates were served with white wine. These feasts were overseen by cupbearers, like the one we hear of at Girsu. A man named Misag was the cupbearer there, and he may very well have been the same Misag who became governor of the city. Perhaps another example, like Sargon, of a cupbearer brought high. Outside of palace feasts, leavened and unleavened bread was consumed, the difference between the two being the former's inclusion of a leavening agent, like yeast. There were also dairy products like milk, cream, cheese, clarified butter, and yogurt cakes called kishik. And for the preservation of meats and a little bit of flavor, we hear of salt being rationed out to those engaged in military or civic service. Lastly, we know that Akkadians and Sumerians living in the empire continued the long-established tradition of brewing, a term that predated both Sumerian and Akkadian. Let us conclude by speaking about the artistic and intellectual pursuits of the Akkadian and Sumerian people. This was a time known as the classical era of Mesopotamian sculpture, and of all the arts, it is sculpture where contemporaneous advances were most impressive. Like with metallurgy, there had already been a long tradition of sculpture, but Akkadian sculptures were in a league of their own. Often depicting the Sargonic line, these sculptures were idealized with well-proportioned musculature and virile, masculine features. They were also bigger than what had come before, weighing 400 kilograms or more. During the reign of Manishtusu, we hear of a sophisticated school of sculptors creating life-size naturalistic statues of the ruler. Made in diorite, these statues were a far cry from the stiff and rigid statues of the past, possessing lifelike limbs, muscles, and garments, something anticipating the ease of a Greek statue in contrapposto. In addition to statues, stelae were made to celebrate Akkadian conquests ever since the reign of Sargon, who ordered these stone slabs featuring scenes of battle to be erected in all corners of his empire. One work in particular, the victory stelae of Naram Sin, stands out as the pinnacle of this art form. Standing roughly 6.5 feet tall and now safely ensconced in the Louvre, this stelae depicts Naram Sin, the legendary grandson of Sargon, towering over friend and foe alike as he tramples an unfortunate member of the Lullaby people beneath his foot. Most notably, even more so than his height, is the helmet that Naram-Sin wears. It is a bullhorned helmet, such as was worn by gods, not men. As we have discussed, Naram-Sin was a prolific hunter, and he famously felled a bull in distant Syria, which this could have been a reference to. But make no mistake, more so than a reference to his hunting excursion, this was a deliberate depiction of his assumed divinity. And as we shall see, later Mesopotamians would accuse Naram-Sin of eventuating the fall of the Akkadian Empire through his hubris. Unlike Sargon, he was not content with merely being the lover of a god. He sought to be a god himself. Personally, I find this immensely interesting when coupled with the satanic imagery of a horned helmet, even if the stele predates Christianity by thousands of years. From the very beginning, it seems, have we, the human race, aspired to godhood. But as regards the other arts, we know that the people of the Akkadian Empire sang and played instruments like the lyre, harp, and drums. But unfortunately, when it comes to music, we don't know much more than that. We do know a thing or two, though, about the poetry of the period, even if it is all basically ascribed to one person, Enheduanna, whose life and times we covered in our episode about Sargon, her father. The works of Enheduanna, written not in Akkadian but Sumerian, span a wide variety of genres, one such being the theme of exploration. It read, quote, "O An, the king, I will roll out your name to the ends of the land, like a surveyor's line. May he, the Akkadian king, take control in the mountain. May he explore it, learning its dimensions. May he go forth on the holy campaign of heaven. May he learn how far it goes." End quote. In the Akkadians, we see the inchoate spirit of exploration, which in much later empires would define their very essence and justification for being. There were also intellectual and bureaucratic advances in the form of map-making, mathematics, cuneiform, and cylinder seals, those gifts passed down from the ancient city of Gilgamesh, Uruk. We know of exercises for finding the areas of squares and rectangles as well as the lengths of the short sides of triangles, precisely the sort of elementary mathematics that would be useful for sizing up and divvying out plots of farmland. We also find some of the earliest maps of, you guessed it, farmland, as well as building sites and the domains of provinces that roughly corresponded to the borders of past city-states. With regard to cylinder seals, these continue to be used in much the same way as in the past, rolled onto a surface to imprint an image that legitimized the quality or authenticity of a good or decree. These seals also constituted a prolific art form, with popular icons including the sun god of the Mesopotamian pantheon, Shamash, and the Akkadian rulers, who were sometimes rendered in a very primal, masculine way, big, naked, and hairy. I have to admit, I find it pretty funny to conjure up the image of a worn-down bureaucrat stamping his approval of a grain shipment with the image of his big, naked, and hairy Akkadian boss. But now, as we reach the end of our tour, let us discuss that fundamental invention that may perhaps be called the wellspring of the city and civilization itself, the writing system. The cuneiform script that had been pioneered in Uruk was gradually adapted to better accommodate the Semitic language of Akkadian, and in the process it was raised to new heights. A fine calligraphic tradition emerged, with cuneiform characters lovingly rendered with plenty of space in between them on rectilinear clay tablets used as administrative documents. In fact, the Akkadians seem to have systemized things with their choice of tablets by using square or rectangular tablets for composite quantities of goods and rounded tablets for single transactions. The angle of orientation on cuneiform characters was also shifted 90 degrees so as to be easier read. Not to mention, it was during this period that cylinder seals were fused with cuneiform for the first time. Prior to that, in the days of temple rule at Uruk, cylinder seals were not rolled on surfaces that had cuneiform characters. Much had changed since that time we covered in the first episode of this series on the Akkadian Empire. And, as far as we can tell, much of the advances described today took place during the reign of a single ruler, one I have mentioned multiple times, Naram Sin, the man who sought to be a god. In the next episode, we will cover his reign, as well as those who came before and after him. But as we shall see, none would compare to his legend, which, though controversial, nonetheless marks him out as special, as the greatest of Sargon's successors, even if perhaps his actions would occasion the fall of the Akkadian Empire.